From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. George W. Bush makes his first international trip as president on Friday when he travels to Mexico to meet with its new president, Vicente Fox. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Sam Quiñones. He's been reporting from Mexico for 7 years. He's the author of the new book, True Tales from Another Mexico. Also, we meet Chico O'Farrell, one of the early innovators of Afro-Cuban jazz. He moved to New York from Cuba in 1945 and wrote for Dizzy Gillespie, Machito, and Stan Kenton. O'Farrell re-records his Afro-Cuban jazz suite on his new CD. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book of short stories by Rick Moody, author of The Ice Storm. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A civilian who was aboard the USS Greenville when the submarine collided with a Japanese fishing vessel may have been given temporary control of the ship. That word from the Pentagon tonight. NPR's Tom Gelton has more.
There were several civilians aboard the Greenville last Friday as the submarine practiced its emergency ascent to the surface. Such visitors are often allowed to take one of the submarine controls, even during a dramatic exercise such as a rapid ascent. A defense official familiar with the investigation of the submarine collision says he understands that one of the civilian visitors on the Greenville last Friday was given that opportunity. "I would not dispute that report," he says. But the official said there is always a helmsman sitting next to the civilian in such a situation, and that the civilian would simply be following the orders of the diving officer and making no independent decisions. The Navy and the National Transportation Safety Board are carrying out separate investigations of the submarine collision. 9 people from the Japanese fishing boat are still missing. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
The House Government Reform Committee is gathering more information related to former President Clinton's pardon of financier Mark Rich. The committee has asked the Secret Service for logs that would show how often Rich's advocates visited the White House. It also subpoenaed contribution information from the Democratic Party and Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton's Senate campaign. Rich's former wife, Denise Rich, was a contributor to both. Denise Rich refused to testify before the panel, citing her Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. The committee has subpoenaed her bank records and those of the Clinton Presidential Library. Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan told the Senate Banking Committee today that he sees signs of improvement in the economy. But Greenspan also said there are downside risks. Steve Beckner reports from Market News International.
In his semi-annual monetary policy report, Greenspan struck a tone of cautious optimism that left the door open for further interest rate cuts, but left in doubt whether the Fed will cut rates as aggressively as it did last month. To quote the Fed chairman, "The exceptional weakness so evident in a number of economic indicators toward the end of last year apparently did not continue in January." He said economic growth slowed to the stalling point as firms cut back production to reduce unsold inventories, but he said that adjustment may take place much faster than usual and projected real growth for the year in the 2-2.5% range. At the same time, he said weak consumer confidence, continued inventory adjustments, and nervousness in financial markets still pose downside risks to the economy. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 43 points to close at 10,903 in active trading. The NASDAQ lost 62 points to close at 2,428. This is NPR News. The British petroleum giant BP Amoco announced record profits of more than $14 billion in 2000, more than double the previous year. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from London.
The profits are the highest recorded by a British company and were made in a year in which protesters brought the country to a near halt over the high price of gasoline. Last week, Royal Dutch Shell reported profits of $13 billion. The twin announcements renewed criticism that motorists are being ripped off. But BP Amoco chief executive Sir John Brown said most profits were not from selling gasoline, but refining it. Taxes on gas make up more than 70% of the cost of fuel in Britain, and oil companies say that's the problem. Still, calls persist for the UK government to impose a windfall tax on the oil giants. Oil and gas make up 5% of the British economy, and it is unlikely that the government will move against the industry for fear of it moving elsewhere. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, London.
Former President Clinton visited an office building in Harlem today that may be his new office. Clinton said he turned to the historic black neighborhood after a controversy over the cost of his first choice, an office in Midtown Manhattan. The Midtown space was reported to cost about $800,000 a year, far more than the federal government has paid for previous presidents' offices. Congressman Charles Rangel, who represents Harlem, said the state-of-the-art office building there represents the neighborhood's revitalization over the past few years. Clinton said working in Harlem could help achieve his goals of bringing economic opportunity to people who don't have it. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America on the web at SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. George W. Bush will make his first presidential trip to another country this Friday when he meets with Mexico's new president, Vicente Fox. Fox is the first Mexican president since 1929 who is not from the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which is known by its Spanish acronym PRI. During the 7 decades PRI ran Mexico, the party became infamous for its corruption, one of the many things that Fox has pledged to change. Fox has also promised to combat crime and drug smuggling. My guest, Sam Quiñones, is a journalist who has been writing about Mexico for 7 years. He has a new book called True Tales from Another Mexico. It's only been a little more than 2 months since Vicente Fox was inaugurated. I asked Sam Quiñones if he could observe any changes in daily life.
I would say the foremost change is a kind of a apprehension mixed with optimism on the part of the people. No one ever believed that the PRI would lose. They voted against the PRI, but they always said, well, someone will change my vote, or there'll be vote fraud and we'll lose. But here what happened on July 2nd, which is when the election took place, was this kind of mass voting. Everyone's just kind of voted and ducked, you know. Gee, I hope he wins. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm sick of the system now. I think lots of people feel now this kind of great optimism. There is some apprehension, like, what's going to happen? We're a little unsure of the future, but the truth is that almost anything would be better than what they had, and I think a lot of people realize that. And so I think the major change that I've noticed is just this kind of change in the attitude of people. They want something different, and they think Fox can give it to them. They're willing to wait a little while, at least, to see that he's at least working towards that. And the more he shows that he is, I think the more chance they'll give him to do it.
President Fox is the first president since 1929, since the creation of the PRI party, that isn't from the PRI party. What did PRI represent? What kind of politics did it stand for?
The PRI represented the great officialist tendency in Mexican society. It's a tendency that has an excessive respect for power, a deference toward position and money. He defeated that primarily, I believe. His defeat of the PRI was a defeat of what had been part of Mexican society since the creation, essentially, of Mexico, which was this officialist concept of the president as kind of God, almost the mayors and governors as kind of princes. When he won, Mexican society was saying, we've had enough of the abuse of these people. And for the first time, it was kind of holding accountable those people who have always been in power in Mexico.
How did PRI manage to hold on to power for so long?
Well, it's a complicated thing, but they created a system very similar to, I like to compare it to, Tammany Hall. If you think of the PRI as a nationwide Tammany Hall, you understand Mexico. Under the PRI, they created a system in which they understood that, unlike, say, the Nazis or the communists in Russia, that ideology was irrelevant, that what they really needed to do was basically buy people off. It was this entire system based on the concept that every man has his price. And in a poor country, it's not really that high. And so what they did was essentially create an entire system using their power as government to just buy people off. And this they did by in a million different ways. They could offer a radical a professorship. They could offer a poor person a piece of land that wasn't his. They could offer a bureaucrat an opportunity to break the law with impunity. All of this created a kind of a system of interests and collusion that was extremely strong for many, many years, and only lost power once that same system couldn't create the wealth that allowed the PRI to buy people off anymore.
In your book, you write about meeting the director of the National Association of Private Schools, and you were looking for some leads and some phone numbers for a story that you were doing. Tell us what he asked for in return.
Well, I went there kind of very wide-eyed, as an American journalist would, hoping for comments, you know, and some names and numbers of private schools so I could do a story on how rough it was for the private schools. He had something else entirely in mind. He asked me for 500 pesos for this information, and I couldn't understand why he would ask me for that. And so I said, well, and he explained, well, the problem is it's very hard to open up our database, and it's going to cost 500 pesos to open up our database, which I couldn't believe at all. There was a computer right there. I could have probably opened it up myself. But the idea was that I didn't really know where I was, and I was in the middle at that moment. It was very early in my time in Mexico. Of the PRI regime. The PRI regime was made up of three pillars of support: the campesinos, the small farmers, the unions, and then this place where I was, which is the organization of the Confederation of Popular Organizations, taxi cab drivers, small businessmen. One of those organizations was the Association of Private Schools. And this man's job was not to make critical comments about the economic situation and how it affected the private schools. It was to essentially support whatever the president said and do so blindly and have his little sinecure in this little grimy office that he had being attended to by a guy who shined his shoes and a woman, the secretary, who would bring him coffee every so often. And apparently, looking for every opportunity to extort a little bit of money from innocent little journalist like myself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Sam Quiñones. His new book is called True Tales from Another Mexico. What does Mexico's new president, Vicente Fox, stand for politically as compared to PRI?
Well, I think what he stands for politically is the opening up of opportunity for the lower echelon of the Mexican economy, which is essentially about two-thirds of the economy that is poor and working class. I think that more than anything is what his promise is for Mexico. Certainly in the economic sphere, he has got to do a lot to open up opportunity, make it easier for these people to go into business for themselves, to do things that they never were able to do under the PRI. Politically, I would say he stands for the modernization of Mexican government. Up to now, Mexican government has been entirely unaccountable, inefficient, inert, and just a colossal waste of taxpayer money. I think what his job now is to make it accountable, open it up, make information available to everyone that comes from the government. Up to now, it's not been. Make it efficient and flexible and agile, because up to now this Mexico has carried this great weight of its bloated and inefficient government on its back, and it has kept Mexico from developing economically, and so the politics and the economics are intertwined here, and you can't separate them. So he's got to break open this for the lower echelons of Mexican society, economic opportunity at the same time as modernizing and making more efficient the Mexican government.
Now Fox has been described as conservative, yet he's also described as the big reform candidate. When people use the word conservative to describe his politics, what does that mean?
Well, I think they're wrong when they describe him that way. But when they use that term, I mean, primarily he comes from the National Action Party, the PAN, and number two, that he was once a member of Coca-Cola de Mexico, the president of Coca-Cola de Mexico, and comes from this big business background. But like Mexico, Fox is very, very difficult to label in this sense, and I think that it's not entirely fair to label him conservative. As governor, for example, he was the first one, he established a Mexican version of the Grameen Bank. The Grameen Bank is the bank in Bangladesh that was set up to get credit and loans into the hands of the poorest women in the society. And he set up a version of that. Now, that's not, in my book, a very conservative policy. I don't know. He's the first one to treat immigrants, people coming from, leaving Mexico, going to the United States to work, with dignity, and treating them actually as people who had economic power and the ability to provide jobs in their own communities. He's had a number of programs that have tried to tap their savings in the United States for productive investment in Mexico. This is a radical change in how the Mexican government views the people who are working in the United States. For many years, you know, they treated them as kind of turncoats, as these nasty people who were stomping on the Mexican flag by going to the gringo and working for the gringo and this kind of thing, even though these people were leaving through no fault of their own, but they couldn't find work in Mexico. This change, you know, is that conservative or is it liberal? I don't know. I think it's a lot of both, and it defies, in a sense, I think, labels. And that's why he is very interesting. That's also why Mexico is very interesting. It defies political ideology and dogma and rhetoric. And his conservatism, yeah, he's a man very interested in the free market and but he's also very interested in getting the lower segments of Mexican society involved in the market, which is something they've never been really able to do up to now.
My guest is journalist Sam Quiñones. His new book is called True Tales from Another Mexico. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Sam Quiñones. He's been writing about Mexico for about 7 years. His new book is called True Tales from Another Mexico. What are some of the promises that President Fox has made to Mexicans?
Well, he promised a whole lot, essentially a transformation of the country in almost every area you can imagine, and environmentally, and education, in terms of the government practices, economically. All of this is going to take many, many years to accomplish. It's not going to happen in his 6 years in office. What he can do in his 6 years is set the foundation so that in the future, first of all, Mexico will not revert to a kind of a pre-style system ever again, number one, that's most important. And number two, that the next president and the next presidents, really, because it's going to take 15, 20 years, I believe, will go beyond what he's done and establish a government that is modern, that responds to its people and is accountable and fair and open. In education, he's got a total revamping of the entire public education system, if you ask me. He's got this horrid system that is a drag on the Mexican economy, turns out really sheep. I don't believe that it turns out thinking, critical, analytical citizens, like a democracy needs, and it has a number of teachers that are really not really worth the money that they're paid, and they're paid very little. Environmentally, the entire country is a disaster. There's not a watershed in Mexico, I think, that's not polluted. He's got to instill a feeling for the environment that does not exist right now. In almost every area you can imagine, he's got building to do. And it's really essentially what he's got to do in general terms is just country building.
Do you have a sense of what President Bush and President Fox want out of the relationship with each other?
I have to say, I don't know what President Bush wants out of the relationship with Mexico, although I assume it's a closer relationship in many ways. I know that Vicente Fox has a number of goals that he'd like to see happen. Number one, just a closer economic relationship, a relationship that deals more in a position of equals and less from parent-child, which has been the attitude up to now of the United States towards Mexico. And that has to change because Mexico now has a legitimately elected government, and it's not going to stand for this kind of attitude on the part of, say, people like Jesse Helms and others, to treat Mexico as if we're like a naughty child. Vicente Fox also wants to create, along the border with the United States, similar to the border with the United States and Canada, where there's this free flow of people, goods, everything is more or less easy to take across. He is a supporter of NAFTA, but he thinks NAFTA didn't go far enough. And Fox would like to see human beings included in NAFTA in some regard, it's not just free flow of goods and services, but that people can more easily go to the United States and work, maybe a guest worker program, this kind of thing. Eventually, what he'd like to see is some kind of common market idea similar to Europe, where people go across the border very easily, a lot more easily than they do now. That's going to take a while because Mexico, we can't open up the borders and without thousands and thousands and thousands of people just pouring into the United States, I think. However, it is something that I think can be achieved in the future. All Mexico just has to develop economically to the point where people don't want to go so much to the United States. And it's just crossing the border is more of like a business trip and that kind of thing.
I don't know if you've had a chance to see the movie Traffic about drug trafficking.
Yeah, I did.
I think that movie is making an impression on a lot of Americans who see it, and part of the movie is about corruption in the Mexican police. What does President Fox have to say about corruption in the police that deal with drugs?
Well, I think he has to say that it's going to be a long fight to weed it out and change the culture of the police forces that deal with drugs. The one dominant thing, though, I think that many Mexicans feel is true, is that as long as the United States continues to use copious quantities of illegal drugs, primarily cocaine and marijuana that come through Mexico, there will be no end to this problem, really. There will always be drug traffickers, and there will always be a certain amount of drug corruption in the police forces. And so it's something that maybe the president can't say. Many, many Mexicans say it all the time. He has set about trying to reform the police departments that deal with drug trafficking. This has happened in my 7 years in Mexico at least two or three times now, where there's a big war on drugs and it involves a reform of the police departments, this kind of thing. I don't know how well it's going to work. You still have the reality of millions, billions of dollars worth of illegal drugs being demanded on the part of the American population. And a lot of them come through Mexico, and that's going to continue to corrode the police forces. So it's a long-term effort. It needs the participation of the American government, and more than just hectoring Mexico to stop being so corrupt and get their act together and this kind of thing. It needs a subtler approach, I think.
President Bush and President Fox each like to wear cowboy boots. Do they have much in common beyond that?
Oh, boy, I don't see a whole lot in common. Certainly Vicente Fox is not, a child of privilege. His parents weren't poor, but they certainly weren't like really wealthy. And I think what he's created, he and his brothers, he and his family have created, has been generally with their own. It's been a bootstrap kind of operation in some sense. Certainly, though, they were never poor. But they never had the kind of opportunities, I think, that were afforded to George W. Bush. Either in business or in his schooling by his father. And that, I think they come in some sense from a little different background in that regard. They don't, Vicente Fox is more of a self-made man, I would say, than George W. Bush.
When you return, you're in Los Angeles right now. When you return to Mexico, which I know you'll be doing soon, what are you going to be looking for?
I think what I want to do when I go back is, in part, cover this country building that Vicente Fox has to engage in. I think that's going to be very, very interesting, and it's going to be hard to do. It's going to be a challenge journalistically, but I think that there's going to be a lot of stories that come out of it that will be important for, I think, Americans to know about. I also want to start covering Mexico, the Mexican diaspora, more. I'm from the Los Angeles area, and every time I come up here, I'm just stunned at the number of Mexicans and how they are changing Mexico, they are changing the United States, and how the experience here in the United States is changing them, making them see government, see economics in a different light. But certainly here in the Los Angeles area, you spend just a short amount of time and it becomes completely apparent that they are the backbone of the LA economy, doing all the worst jobs and some of the better ones too nowadays. And so I want to get away from simply looking at Mexico as a country bound by these borders that we all know, and looking at Mexico in terms of Chicago and Texas and Los Angeles and the Central Valley of California. That, I think, is where my journalistic tendencies are leading me these days.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been great being on. Thank you very much.
Journalist Sam Quiñones is the author of the new book, True Tales from Another Mexico. Tenor saxophonist Buddy Tate died Saturday at the age of 87. He first became known for his work with the Count Basie Band, which he joined in 1939 and played with for 10 years. We'll hear a recording he made in 1977 with the South African pianist and composer Abdullah Ibrahim. This is Just You, Just Me. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Music by composer and arranger Chico O'Farrell. Coming up, we talk with O'Farrell, one of the early composers of Afro-Cuban jazz. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book of short stories by Rick Moody. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Chico O'Farrell was one of the first composers and arrangers to combine Afro-Cuban sounds with jazz. He grew up in Havana and moved to New York in 1948, where he wrote and arranged for Machito, Dizzy Gillespie, Stan Kenton, and Benny Goodman. O'Farrell returned to Cuba in 1955, moved to Mexico in 57, and stayed there 8 years before returning to New York. During the 70s and 80s, he had to make his living writing and arranging commercial jingles. In 95, he made a jazz comeback and began leading his Afro-Cuban jazz big band. His band often performs in New York under the supervision of his son, pianist Arturo O'Farrell. Chico O'Farrell is now 79. His new CD is called Carambola. I asked him how he first started combining Afro-Cuban rhythms with jazz.
Well, in Cuba, before I came to the United States, there was a group of us who loved jazz, and we found a lot of Cuban music boring, you know, monotonous. So we all dream about, you know, having the richness and the excitement of jazz music, harmonies, together with Cuban rhythms, and combine the two so it will be a new kind of music.
You said you found Cuban music boring. Why did you find it boring?
Well, because the Cuban music at the time was, you know, Montuno, so the one phrase that repeated itself at infinitum, you know, same, over and over and over. There was no richness, and there was nothing to go to. It was all the same. It was, you know, Montuno, ding, 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 ding,
Norman Granz, the founder of Jazz at the Philharmonic
and
Verve Records, asked you to write an Afro-Cuban jazz suite for Machito. Charlie Parker ended up on the session because one of the other soloists couldn't make it. So Norman Granz sent for Parker. What was your reaction? Did you think that that was good news that Parker was going to be there instead of the person you had planned on?
Well, of course, because Bird at the time was already one of the up-and-coming brilliant minds in the jazz field. So to me, it was a thrill to have somebody like Charlie Parker in that recording.
Well, why don't we hear the solo that he took on your Afro-Cuban jazz suite as recorded in 1950? Chico O'Farrell, were you happy with Charlie Parker's solo?
Oh, yes. Bird was unique. He had a style, a sound, and a concept that were unique. In fact, he was so unique that he influenced a whole collection of sax players to imitate him.
Now, you've re-recorded the Afro-Cuban Jazz Suite on your latest CD.
Yes.
What sounds different in this version than the original?
Well, this version, to a certain extent, preserves the excitement of the original Machito Orchestra rhythm section, whereas the horn sections, to some extent, are better rehearsed and play better than in the original session. So I think our interpretation of this one now is a better interpretation in general than the original one.
Well, let's hear the new version of Chico O'Farrell's Afro-Cuban Jazz Suite.
Thank you.
That's the opening of the Afro-Cuban Jazz Suite from Chico O'Farrell's new CD, Carambola. You wrote the Afro-Cuban Jazz Suite after you moved to New York. And I'm wondering if you heard Cuban music in a different way once you started living in New York and once you started composing and arranging Afro-Cuban-inspired jazz.
Well, when I came to New York, my whole musical mind changed in a way that I was like a new musician. For one thing, I was listening to some of my idols in person, people like Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker. I was listening to these people in person, which is not the same as listening to records. And so my mind was very much more attuned to this type of thing than when I was living in Cuba.
When you were living in New York in the late 40s and early 50s, you did a lot of arranging for other people's bands.
Yes.
You did some arranging for Machito, for Dizzy Gillespie, for Benny Goodman, Stan Kenton.
Yes.
And you've described yourself as the ghostwriter of the ghostwriters.
I was the ghost of the ghost.
What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm not going to name names, but certain big name arrangers were writing for Benny Goodman, Count Basie, and but he didn't write a lot of it. He had a ghostwriter write it. And I, the ghostwriter, eventually, you know, had too much work.
So you were doing ghostwriting for people who were hired to arrange things and weren't getting much credit in the first place.
That's right.
But you must have learned a lot doing that.
Of course I did. That was the main reason I did it, so I was exposed directly to the musical medium that I loved and learned more about it.
Now, I want to play something else from your new CD, Carambola. In fact, I want to play the title track. It's a piece that you wrote for Dizzy Gillespie. When did you write it, and tell us about the occasion for writing this?
Well, this is a piece that, frankly, I don't remember exactly when I wrote it. You know, sometimes you write and write and write, and you just put it away. And the thing was to... it was a job to do for the Dizzy Gillespie Orchestra, and then it became a fairly big hit for the orchestra. Frankly, there's no particular reason why I wrote that. I just wrote it.
Okay. Well, let's hear it. This is Carambola, the title track of Chico O'Farrell's latest CD. Music from Chico O'Farrell's new CD, Carambola. O'Farrell will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My My guest is Chico O'Farrell, one of the first musicians to compose and arrange music that combined Afro-Cuban sounds with jazz. He has a new CD called Carambola. What was your ethnic background in Cuba? Where were your parents from?
My father was originally from Ireland. Figure that out. And my mother was originally also from a German background. So I'm a mess. I admit it.
So your father was from Ireland and your mother from Germany? Or from German background?
Not that really. Just their background, yes.
Uh-huh. And so what kind of music did they listen to when you were growing up?
I really don't remember much except them listening to Cuban, typical Cuban music. But they didn't listen to much music. They were not music lovers, really. I have to say that.
And what did they think of you listening to and then playing jazz?
They weren't very happy about it. As a matter of fact, I remember when I decided to become a musician, I was supposed to go to law school and become an attorney.
Your father and grandfather were both lawyers.
Right, so I was supposed to become an attorney and follow in the family's footsteps. But one day I decided I was going to become a musician and I announced it to the family. And I remember my grandma was very, very austere, saying, "Arturo, if you're going to be a musician, be a good one. Remember Mozart."
So she wanted you to play classical music.
Yeah, she wanted me to do classical music. And for them, jazz, you know, including most popular music, jazz, and all of it was like a little bit vulgar music.
You told Peter Watrous for an article in the New York Times, you said,
yes.
"Cuban society has always been very racist. My parents were shocked that I was playing black music. Black musicians rarely played classical music, and white musicians didn't play Afro-Cuban music or jazz." Tell me more about that, about the racial divisions within music in Cuba when you were growing up.
Well, undoubtedly, there was a cultural difference. Like culture there, in every word, painting or literature, or had a side that was purely black and a side that was purely white. Sometimes the two meshed together, but most of the time they stayed separate. Why? Because Cuban society, to a certain extent, was organized, racially speaking, in the same model that it was organized in the United States.
I imagine, judging from this quote, that in Cuba you were considered white and also upper middle class. When you got to New York and you were playing jazz, do you think that jazz musicians thought of you as white or thought of you as Latino?
Well, I wasn't sure at the time. And to tell you the truth, I didn't care much what they considered me. What I wanted to do was play good music. So I didn't care whether they considered me white or Latin or whatever.
When you started arranging and conducting in New York, I imagine people went to you thinking, well, this is the guy who does the Afro-Cuban jazz stuff, so let's have him do some more Afro-Cuban jazz stuff.
A
steady diet, right. Did you ever wish that people would just ask you to write straight jazz without the Afro-Cuban rhythms? Did you ever...
Yes, well, once you write something in a certain style, they typecast you, and you are the writer in that particular style, you're the biggest one. Afro-Cuban jazz, for example, I wrote some Afro-Cuban jazz starting with Benny Goodman, with Norman Granzer. Then I became the Afro-Cuban jazz writer.
So was that ever frustrating, being the Afro-Cuban jazz writer as opposed to just the jazz writer?
Well, it's very frustrating because, for example, I can write for Count Basie, Stan Kenton, Benny Goodman. I could write for any kind of American music, you know, any kind of jazz music. But then they pigeonhole you and put you there, and that's it.
Are you still composing now?
Yes, of course. I never stop composing. I'm writing things for my orchestra right now, and we're planning on doing a new record pretty soon.
I want to play another track from your new CD, and this is called Crazy City, But I Love It. What's the city that this composition is about?
Well, guess. Chicago? Nah. Toronto? Nah.
Havana or New York?
How about New York? Try New York.
New York, okay.
Yeah, of course.
And what were the impressions of New York you wanted to capture in this piece?
I wanted to capture the musical sounds as well as the feeling of the city and the mixture of Latin and jazz rhythms, which is so typically unique of New York.
So let's hear it. This is Crazy City, But I Love It. Well, this piece is called Crazy City, ... But I Love It. Did you always love New York when you moved there, or did it take you a while to adjust to it?
No, I love it. The first minute I walked in here, I loved it.
How come?
There was something about the atmosphere. It was such a dynamic city, such a vibrant city. And especially because I was in love with jazz at the time, and this was the center of jazz, it became the center of my activities, so I loved it.
Thank you so much. I love your music, and I wish you the best.
Thank you, and I thank the public for listening to me, and you all have a good time.
So here's Crazy City from Chico O'Farrell's new CD, Carambola. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Rick Moody's new collection of short stories. This is Fresh Air. Rick Moody, who's perhaps best known for his novel The Ice Storm, has been hailed as one of the best of the younger generation of writers by magazines like Harper's and The New Yorker. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that his writing can win your heart, but like lots of other young men, he's fickle.
The first-person narrators in the best of Rick Moody's short stories published in Demonology remind me a bit of Holden Caulfield. Older, even sadder, nevertheless, Moody's narrators can't quite tamp down their funny enthusiasms, nor do they even try to restrain their loathing of phonies. The first story, The Mansion on the Hill, and the last one, the title one, Demonology, are astonishing. The kinds of stories whose atmosphere and voices haunt you long after you forget other details. The other 11 stories range from entertaining to accomplished to annoying creative writing class finger exercises. No matter. just as it's worth reading the minor tales in James Joyce's Dubliners to get to the dead, it's worth buying Demonology just to own copies of Moody's two stunners between hardcovers. Like Joyce's The Dead, like it seems 75% of all the literature ever written, Moody's two great short stories are about death. In fact, they have more in common. They're both about the deaths of the narrator's sisters. At first, The Mansion on the Hill threatens to feature one of my least favorite types of characters, the American eccentric, that whimsical fellow, or more rarely, that gal, who teeters on the margins of the mainstream. I was wrong. Granted, Moody's narrator, Andrew, does first appear in a rubber chicken costume, handing out flyers for a fast food joint called Hot Bird. But he has a good excuse. He's reeling from a tragedy. We find out partway through the story that his cherished sister, Eileen, recently died in a car crash on her way to her own wedding rehearsal dinner. Andrew soon lands a better job at the place that gives this story its title. The Mansion on the Hill is a cinder block wedding palace where, Andrew says, we were in the business of spreading joy by any means necessary. We were in the business of paring away the calluses of woe and grief to reveal the bright light of commitment. Even in the hands of a lesser writer than Moody, the mansion's endless weekend processions of over-the-top wedding affairs would provide plenty of material for mirth. But when Eileen's former fiancé, a certified beret-wearing charlatan named Bryce, turns up at the mansion to wed a new intended, Andrew's raging grief bursts through his acceptable demeanor of ironic melancholy. Clad in his old chicken mask, Andrew showers Bryce not with the traditional rice, but with the ashes and bones of his cremated sister. And why not, this story seems to calmly ask. After all, what could be more absurd, more grotesque than death itself? As a story, Demonology is much more raw than Mansion on the Hill, and that's the brilliance of its placement in this collection. Since it comes at the end of the book, Demonology predictably should be more resolved, more accepting of the death, here by a freak heart seizure, of the unnamed narrator's sister. Instead, it's rambling, indecisive, and vividly elegiac. The story opens on Halloween, and here's part of its dizzying, paragraph-length first sentence. They came in twos and threes, dressed in the fashionable Disney costumes of the year, Lion King, Pocahontas, Beauty and the Beast, or in the costumes of televised superheroes, Protean, shape-shifting, thus arrayed in twos and threes, complaining it was too hot with the mask on. Hey, I'm really hot. Lugging those orange plastic buckets as the parents tarried behind, grown-ups bantering about the schools or about movies, about local sports, about their marriages, about the difficulties of long marriages, kids sprinting up the next driveway, kids decked out as demons or superheroes or dinosaurs or as advertisements for our multinational entertainment providers, beating back the restless souls of the dead in search of sweets. If you really want to hear about it, as Holden Caulfield would say, the rest of Moody's stories in Demonology concern stuff like yuppies homesteading in Hoboken, middle Americans trying to get rich quick by raising ostriches, and Cheever-esque suburbanites staring at their own mortality in the bottom of a martini glass. Those stories are mostly fine, but the two tales that frame this collection are in a different short story stratosphere altogether.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Demonology, a collection of short stories by Rick Moody. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Confessions of a Shopaholic, a novel by British author Sophie Kinsella. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how mothers are financially penalized. We talk with journalist Ann Crittenden about her new book, The Price of Motherhood, why the most important job in the world is still the least valued. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.